Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, August 25th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Report, 621 new COVID cases in 2 days. Preliminary numbers will likely mean the largest two-day total of pandemic. By Stuart Doreen. The Midland Health Department is reporting that there have been more than 620 new cases of COVID-19 in 2 days inside Midland County. The report is technically a preliminary number, and the number is likely expected to drop from 621 as contact tracing takes place. However, even a 10% drop would still make Monday 343 cases and Tuesday 278 cases the largest two-day total of the pandemic. On Tuesday, Dr. Larry Wilson said unofficial totals would be reported to show the community of the basic trends taking place. What the addition of August 12th to 17th shows are more days with 100 or more cases. Since August 2nd, every weekday has had a triple-digit total. It also shows that weekly total of new cases will increase to 7 from 14 cases on June 20th to 26th to 947 cases on August 8th to the 14th. Through just 3 days this week, the total number of cases has been 743, which means it is likely that the streak of week-over-week increases will move to 8. Lastly, the unofficial total of cases this month is 2,353. Midland health officials have been consistent in saying that more cases mean Midland Memorial Hospital and its staff can expect more patients, typically 7 to 10 days later. On Tuesday morning, the number of COVID-19 inpatients had reached 115, one short of the record for any one day during the pandemic. Other highlights from Tuesday morning presser included, of the 115 patients, 88% were unvaccinated. That meant 14 breakthrough cases. Note, the Reporter Telegram incorrectly reported a lower vaccination rate of inpatients on Monday. MMH officials stated it was 87% Monday morning. The hospital is averaging 11 new COVID patients a day. That is up from 1 in June and 3 in July. The number of people visiting the emergency room on Monday was 202. Midland health officials said that number was 118 on the same day in 2020. The age ranges of the COVID-19 patients are 19 to 78. Anyone interested in volunteering at the upcoming mass booster vaccination site can email vaxvolunteers@midland-health.org. Emergency staff arriving in the past few days include 10 respiratory therapists, 13 critical care nurses, and 5 medical surgical nurses. The hours of the vaccination clinic Friday at the F. Marie Hall Outpatient Center, former West Campus, are 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. Midland health officials, when asked if there is a large migrant population in the COVID wards, stated that there were 12 that were not Midland County residents. So that's certainly not driving the COVID volume, Midland Health COO said, of the idea of migrants driving up the inpatient count in Midland. It's not from migrants or from people outside our community. This article is entitled City. A Street work should be done in October. City staff asking council to consider new construction. By Mella McEwen. Road improvement projects under the 2017 road improvement bond are nearing completion, members of City Council were reminded. At a council briefing prior to the council meeting, Jose Ortiz, Engineering Services Director for the City of Midland, reported that 26 projects have been completed, 5 are under construction, and the last 4 projects under the bond will be going out to bid as the program enters its 5th year in 2022. Council Member Scott Dufford asked about the status of A Street, noting that he is frequently asked when construction will be complete. Ortiz said that the stretch from Indiana Avenue to Cuthbert Avenue should be completed by late October and cited weather as a reason for delays. Ortiz turned his attention to several unfunded projects for which possible funding has been identified. Those include paving unpaved streets as well as alleys and sidewalks. Construction projects he discussed include Industrial Avenue from Loop 250 to Midkiff Road, extending Wadley Avenue from Callaway Street to State Highway 158, reconstructing Wadley from Garfield Street to I Street, Golf Course Road from Andrews Highway to Scarborough Drive, Todd Road from Business 20 to Golf Course Road and Briarwood Avenue were also on the list of suggested projects. Council members also received an update on Centennial Park from Stephanie Martin, Executive Director of Midland Downtown Park Conservancy, which operates, maintains, and programs the 4-acre park that covers 2 blocks in downtown Midland. The $18 million project, funded through private-public partnerships, opened 9 months ago, Martin said. It hosted 29 events free to the public in June and July and was rented out for 8 events, including birthday parties and special use permits. There were 27 visits from food trucks during that time period. The park only allows food trucks Thursday through Saturday, and each food truck can reserve the space for 1 day a week for a month or a single day for a special event. We will continue to educate the community and update them about events at the park, she said. This is the local page. This article is entitled Council to Fund Half of $4.776 million Grant to Midland Memorial Hospital by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council approved funding half of a $4.766 million grant for the Midland County Hospital District. The grant is for the purpose of funding projects related to Midland Health's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Council members approved an amendment from Lori Blong that called for funding half of the request and asking for Midland County to fund the other half. The hospital district originally asked for full funding from the city. In a letter from Russell Myers, president of Midland Health, to Robert Patrick, Midland City Manager, the hospital district commits to spend $3 million in a one-time bonus for every Midland Health employee below the department director level, in recognition of their steadfast and continuing service in the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The hospital district also will commit to spend $336,000 for hourly differentials and extra shift incentives for COVID caregivers. The total request represents an estimated $48,000 in incentives per week for 7 weeks through the end of September, Myers wrote. The last of the expenditures within the category of premium pay for essential workers is $1.4 million in incremental cost of adding contract professional staff. Midland Memorial Hospital's contract labor run rate has risen from $350,000 per week to $550,000. The total request represents 7 weeks of this $200,000 differential through the end of September, Myers wrote. Councilman Spencer Robnett and Scott Dufford both made references that they wanted the hospital district to receive some funding immediately and not have any payment contingent on the county commissioners. Robnett even said he isn't wanting to close the door for the hospital district to return to the city should the county not approve funding half of the request. Previous federal funding donated from the city to the hospital district went for the infusion center that helps COVID patients early on in their fight with the disease. Money also went to help set up and operate mass vaccination centers, according to Myers. This article is entitled ECISD to Hold Masks Meeting by J.C. Lewis. Ector County ISD will consider a mask resolution. A special meeting of the Board of Trustees for Ector County ISD will be held at 6 p.m. Thursday at the Administrative Building Boardroom. The meeting will have a discussion of a resolution regarding temporary mask use by staff and students. An executive session is on the agenda as well. As of Monday, the school district had 8 staff members reported positives and 79 students reported positive across campuses. This article is entitled Midland Leaders Spend Millions in Federal Money by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council passed a trio of items Tuesday having to do with the accepting and spending of COVID funding. The first item called for the accepting and appropriating of $12.494 million of funds through the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021. The total represents the first tranche of funds, according to Council agenda documents, as the city was awarded $24.988 million from the ARPA. The first tranche was received in May 2021, and the second is to be received in May 2022. These funds must be spent by December 31, 2026, and all costs incurred by December 31, 2024. Funds must be spent according to the interim rule from the Department of Treasury for the following: response to the COVID-19 pandemic, premium pay, revenue loss, infrastructure capital for water and sewer or broadband. City Council to spend $1.9 million in bonuses for critical service personnel. The last of the three items the Council passed call for $1.9 million in CARES Act grant project funding that will provide a 3% one-time merit payment for critical service personnel. They include fire personnel, police personnel, communications personnel, airport operations personnel, facilities personnel, information technology personnel, solid waste personnel, transportation personnel, traffic operations personnel, and utilities personnel. City documents state this will impact approximately 700 employees who reported to work during the pandemic. Active employees are eligible for the one-time payment if hired prior to December 31st, 2020. The other item approved called for the funding of half of a $4.766 million grant to the Midland County Hospital District for projects related to Midland Health's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. This article is entitled Officials: Hospitals Won't Prescribe Touted Protocols by Matt Stringer, Odessa Headlines. Officials with Medical Center Hospital, MCH, and Odessa Regional Medical Center, ORMC, in Odessa held a press conference on Monday addressing continued overcapacity crisis and numerous obstacles the recent spike in COVID-19 cases is causing. Among the many items addressed during the online press conference that dominated the discussion was the hospital's position on treatment protocols, namely budesonide and ivermectin, that have been touted by numerous physician groups and aggressively shared on social media, with the hospital saying they will not be using treatments that are not globally accepted. "There are a lot of treatment protocols that float around out there," said Dr. Rohith Saravanan of ORMC. "There are several that groups of people that have put out, groups of physicians have put out. But you have to understand, in our region, we have stayed consistent with CDC, FDA, and NIH guidelines." Saravanan went on to further, calling out budesonide and ivermectin specifically, and stated that if you see treatment protocols that include these, you will not receive them at our hospital, ORMC. But said patients are welcome to bring it up for discussion with their staff so they can educate you on what it is. Both hospitals indicated that discussions with patients and their families related to using budesonide and ivermectin have got heated and have had to call security on occasions.
MCH CEO Russell Tippin commented on the usage of ivermectin, pointing to the instances in which people have obtained and used the substance from farm supply stores due to its common usage in treating horses for heartworms, and said he heard it put best on a radio show by someone saying that, quote, unless you moo or eat hay, it's probably not for you. Budesonide, which is an inhaled steroid used for decades to treat asthma, has gained national attention, having been touted by Odessa physician Dr. Richard Bartlett as part of his treatment regimen for COVID patients. Numerous private physicians in the Permian Basin are rumored to also be prescribing Bartlett's protocol, as well as a number of doctors across the country and the world. A recent study published by medical researchers from Oxford University's Principal Trial Program in England found that with 50-year-old and above patients with comorbidities, early administration of inhaled budesonide reduces the likelihood of needing urgent medical care and reduces time to recover following early COVID-19 infection. The principal group is also currently conducting a study on ivermectin. While budesonide is now categorized as something doctors can use case by case in treated COVID-19 in the United Kingdom, health authorities in the United States are not embracing it the same way. According to the National Institute of Health, NIH, COVID-19 treatment guidelines, there is insufficient evidence for the NIH panel to recommend either for or against the use of inhaled budesonide for the treatment of COVID-19. And the NIH guidelines holds a similar position for ivermectin, saying more study of the medication is needed. Dr. Saravanan also addressed the recent FDA approval of the Pfizer brand vaccine in treating COVID-19 patients, stating that while the emergency use authorization is still in place for 12 to 15-year-old patients, the full authorization applies to patients 16 and up. Saravanan said that with the FDA approval, we should start seeing more mandatory vaccine requirements, such as private employers requiring vaccines as a condition of employment, and pointing to how the federal government is already mandating vaccines as a condition for federal employment. Both MCH and ORMC reported they are over capacity with the recent spike in COVID cases and urged local officials to cancel events that may include large gatherings. This column is called Small Bites. It is entitled Bar with Specialty Cocktails to Add to Downtown Scene. The bar will be in the basement of the Bank of America building. By J.C. Lewis. Sip House will add to the downtown bar scene as soon as October or November. Co-owners Lee Sanchez and Emilio Castellon are excited to bring a new different bar to the basement of the Bank of America building. The owners said they are excited to revamp the space and create a cocktail menu featuring martini flights and more. I had this idea for a while, but we have been so busy with Sculpt House, but I wanted to bring something unique and different to Midland, Sanchez said. Now that downtown is really starting to flourish, I want to be a part of bringing something fun to the area. Sanchez said he loves how family-oriented downtown has become and hopes that it will translate to being an active spot for young professionals to enjoy a night of dinner and drinks. There is a new energy in Midland the last 2 or 3 years, Castellon added. People want to invest in downtown and make it better for the community. He liked the basement area of the Bank of America building, where Bruce Street previously had a location, because it gives off a speakeasy vibe, he said. It's a smaller space, so he doesn't plan on doing as much advertising, but people will hear about the cocktail bar through the word of mouth. Sip House will have a similar concept as Sculpt House. It will be very modern, luxurious, and unrivaled in its own sense, Sanchez said. The cocktail bar will be doing custom classic cocktails with a modern twist, with charcuterie boards in the evening. In the mornings, they will offer coffee, juice, and light breakfast. The space will predominantly serve as a cocktail lounge. The breakfast is mostly a plus the space can utilize, he said.
Castellon said they will be bringing parts of service from Sculpt House to Sip House. "We never want clients to feel rushed or like we are rushing them," he said. "We take our time to set up a treatment plan with clients, and we want to take time to create a special experience when it comes to Sip House." The cocktail bar will create a martini flight so patrons can experience different types of martinis to figure out how they like their martinis. The thing about martinis is that everyone knows what a martini is, but less people know what is in it or how to make it with the different variations, Sanchez said. Castellon added that people can try martinis with gin or vodka, dry or extra dry, or dirty or filthy. "People can know about it, but there's so many ways to make it that people can easily mess it up," he said. "We would like people to figure out what they like in a martini." When patrons visit Sip House, they will be greeted by a host in the Bank of America lobby, who will then check them in and escort them down the elevator to the bar. There will also be the great poolside disco music that is always on at Sculpt House. There possibly will be DJs, depending on space available and capacity. They plan to change the menu seasonally and have themed drinks during certain times of the year. "In order to keep people excited about something, we have to constantly change it up and not just become an establishment that stays the same," Sanchez said. Sanchez and Castellon are both from the area originally and opened Sculpt House last year. They also own a home health agency called Trinity Provider Services for more than 10 years. "We love hosting," Sanchez said. "We have a lot of get-togethers at our house, and I love creating a charcuterie board, and Emilio is great at making drinks. We complement each other with our entertainment that I wanted to bring to the public." More food news. Join Meals on Wheels Odessa to celebrate the 105th birthday of Dorothy Nelms by decorating cars and joining a parade at 5:30 p.m. this Saturday at Woodson Park. Final brunch will be from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. September 12th at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Convention Center. West Texas Fest announces food truck lineup for the upcoming event on October 1st. Food trucks include Brantley Creek Barbecue and Company LLC, Cane Doro Pizza, Chaw's Tacos, and Gilly's Mobile Diner. Pondicetta Brewing Company, Deep Ellum Brewing Company, Tall City Brewing Company, Eccentric Brewing Company, Flecha Azul Tequila, Rebecca Creek Distillery, and Belt Buckle Distillery will be available at this year's feast. Local organizations can soon apply for support from Raising Cane's during the chain's 25th anniversary celebration this year. The fried chicken restaurant has pledged to commit $25 million to communities it serves. To apply, visit raisingcane's.com/canes-and-your-community. This article is entitled "China's Success at Quelling Virus Leads to Oil Rally" by Sheila Tobin, Bloomberg. Oil extended gains from the biggest jump in 5 months as China's success in stamping out virus flare-ups boosts optimism of a demand recovery. U.S. oil futures rose 2.9%, while Brent topped $71 a barrel. Crude clung to gains after an industry-funded group reported after the close that stockpiles fell last week. China has rapidly brought local virus cases down to zero, and road traffic is showing signs of recovery. The country also reopened its Ningbo port, one of the busiest in the world, after a two-week shutdown. The developments out of China are reigniting expectations that oil demand would start to rise again, said Phil Flynn, senior market analyst at Price Futures Group, Inc. Meanwhile, a fire on a Mexican oil platform wiped out more than 400,000 barrels a day of the nation's output, roughly equivalent to what OPEC Plus will discuss adding back to the market when it meets next month.
COVID's resurgence has interrupted oil's rally and prompted speculation that OPEC Plus may reassess its current plan to return additional barrels to the market when it meets September 1st. Goldman Sachs Group Inc., however, reiterated that the demand impact from Delta would be transient, while UBS Group AG sees Brent crude recovering to $75 a barrel on market tightness. This week's rally has coincided with a sharp strengthening in time spreads that indicate prompt demand. The difference between the nearest two December Brent futures contracts jumped by $1 a barrel in the past 2 days. Gains in the global benchmark increased its premium to WTI to the widest since April. Later this week, investors also will be considering the Jackson Hole Symposium being held virtually from Thursday, which may offer insights into how the Federal Reserve plans to scale back stimulus. Meanwhile, the American Petroleum Institute reported $1,622 million decline in U.S. crude stockpiles and a nearly 1 million drop in gasoline stocks. The group also reported a 245,000 barrel dip in distillate stocks last week, which, if confirmed by the U.S. government Wednesday, would be the smallest drop since January. Despite the positive strides against the Delta variant, hurdles still remain to restoring demand. Chinese airlines plan to operate the fewest flights in August since February, according to data from Cirium. In Malaysia, rising infections are threatening to aggravate shortages of semiconductors and other components that have hammered automakers for months. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, August 25th. Catherine Cathy Reynolds. Catherine was born on August 5th, 1933 in Joplin, Missouri, to Orville Snyder and Madeline Snyder. She passed away in Midland, Texas on August 21st, 2021. Catherine is preceded in death by her parents, Orville and Jane Snyder, and her mother, Madeline Karch. She is also preceded in death by her husband, Wayne, one great-grandson, Ian William Boykin, and her sister, Helen Harrison. Catherine is survived by four children, Marcia, Bill Boykin, Randy Diana Reynolds, Larry Letha Reynolds of Midland, and Kenny Connie of Colorado City. She was grandmother to 13 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and 4 great-great-grandchildren. She is also survived by her sister, Beverly Oling of Cypress, Texas, and her brother, Robert Norma Snyder of Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. The family would like to ask that in lieu of flowers, you make a donation to the Mission Center Adult Daycare Services at 3500 North A Street, number 1300, Midland, 79705, or Hospice of Midland, 911 West Texas Avenue, Midland, 79701, or the Alzheimer's Association. Public visitation will be held Thursday, August 26th from 5 to 7 p.m. Funeral service will be at 10 a.m. Friday, August 27th at Ellis Funeral Home in Midland and officiated by Freddie Haltom. Interment will follow at Rest Haven North next to her late husband. Memories and condolences may be shared with Cassie's family at www.ellisfunerals.com. Claude Urban Jewett Jr. Claude Urban Jewett Jr. was born on July 20, 1946, to Claude Jewett and Betty Jewett. He grew up in Missouri and South Dakota. He was preceded in death by his parents, Claude and Betty Jewett, his sister Patricia Branham, and wife Johnny Doyleen Jewett. He is survived by his three children, Claude I. Jewett III, and grandson Brody, his son Matthew, and wife Stacy, and grandsons Jack and Raymond, son John Jewett, and grandchildren Bailey, Camden, and Aiden, as well as four stepchildren, as well as brothers, sisters, nieces, and nephews. The viewing will be held from 12 to 9 p.m. Thursday, August 26th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 9 a.m. Friday, August 27th at Fannin Terrace Baptist Church. Graveside service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, August 27th at Texas State Veterans Cemetery in Abilene. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be sent to the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry at 1179 Almonason Road, Westville, New Jersey, 08093, or the Midland Animal Shelter. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklenwelt Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Molly Cothran. Molly Sue Adams Cothran of Odessa passed away on August 24th after a heroic 2.5-year battle with pancreatic cancer. Molly is survived by her beloved husband of 56 years, Ray Cothran, son Chad Cothran and his wife Jan of Dallas, son Jason and his wife Karen, grandson Cooper and granddaughter Ella of Abilene, brother Dale Adams and wife Debbie of Watauga, Texas. Molly was preceded in death by her parents, John Edgar and Desi D. Adams, brother Gerald Adams, brother Robert Adams, sister Helen Colburn, sister Lolly Pierce, and sister Desi Goretzka. Family and friends will gather to celebrate Molly's life from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, August 26th at Nally Picklenwelt's Funeral Home. Memorial services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, August 27th at Nally Picklenwelt's Funeral Home Chapel. Live streaming of the service will be available at www.npwelch.com. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklenwelt's Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Pat Hodges. Pat Hodges, 74, of Grand Saline, his service is scheduled for 2 p.m. Wednesday, August 25th at Barclay Funeral Home with Kyle White officiating. Interment will be in Woodside Cemetery. Ms. Hodges passed away August 20th in Dallas. She was born November 21st, 1946 in Dallas to Edward Ray and Mattie Mosel Elliott Hodges. Survivors include her daughter Holly Fletcher and Brian Wingo of Grand Saline, two grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, and numerous other relatives and friends. Memorials may be made to the Old School Museum in Grand Saline. The family will receive friends 1 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home before the service. Death notices. Maria Guadalupe Barrientos. Maria Guadalupe Barrientos, 91, of Midland, passed away Sunday, August 22nd. Viewing will be Wednesday, August 25th, from 1 to 9 p.m., with a rosary being recited at 7 p.m. Wednesday evening at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Thursday, August 26th, at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. He is survived by his two sons, Ricardo Barrientos and Pablo Barrientos, one daughter, Luz Sherrod, and numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
This is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, August 25th, 2021. ECISD to consider mask resolution by OA News at oaoa.com. The Ector County ISD Board of Trustees will gather in a special meeting at 6 p.m. Thursday in the first floor boarding room of the Administration Building, 802 North Sam Houston Avenue, to discuss and approve a resolution regarding temporary mask use by staff and students. Before the mask discussion, the agenda says the board will meet in closed session in consultation with the board's attorney on a matter in which the duty of the attorney to the governmental body under the Texas Disciplinary Rules of Professional Conduct of the State Bar of Texas clearly conflicts with this chapter. The board will discuss and consider taking action in open session. The district's attorney, Mike Adkins, said the language from the agenda is directly from the Open Meetings Act. I will be discussing with the board the legal implications of masking, just trying to bring them up to date on the litigation, which changes as we speak, in the state of Texas, so they'll know the legal parameters before they go into open session, which is where they will actually discuss what, if anything, they're going to do, Adkins said Tuesday. There are several times that a board or any governmental body can go into executive session with their attorneys. One of the most obvious is if they're in the middle of litigation or if there is a threat of litigation. But there are also times when there may or may not be litigation, Adkins said. As an example, say you wanted to see your attorney because you're thinking about doing some things and what legally would that implicate. That conversation you have with that attorney is confidential. That's all this is. It ties back to the ethical duty of the attorney, and the ethical duty of an attorney is to maintain the confidence of a client to consult with you and keep in confidence the things that you consult with your client about. COVID cases and hospitalizations have exploded in Ector County of late. During a Zoom news conference Monday with health officials, Medical Center Hospital CEO Russell Tippin said the hospital hit a higher number of COVID-related patients than ever, with 106 over the weekend. Comparatively, MCH hit 102 or 103 in January. On Tuesday morning, MCH had 99 total COVID patients in-house. They had 96 Monday. Odessa Regional Medical Center CEO Stacy Brown said Monday the hospital had 26 COVID patients as of Monday. According to the Texas Tribune, the Texas Supreme Court cleared the way last Thursday for school districts to require people to wear masks in classrooms, at least for now. Adkins said it's hard to say what the status of masking is until it works its way through the courts. Nobody knows how long that's going to take, he said. That's what that is about, to give them an up-to-date assessment of where they are and the implications to them and the district legally. Some districts have made masks part of the dress code. Asked about whether there's any provision to take action based on the public good, Adkins said there have been arguments on both sides. There have been 80-page briefs filled with legal arguments about why the government can, and the same amount of briefs filed about why the governor cannot. That's the whole point about until it works its way through the courts, and the court definitely says this is going to be the prevailing rule. We're in somewhat of a legal state of limbo. Campus plans, programs discussed by Ruth Campbell. Plans to transform the campus, new programs and activities and incentives for COVID shots were among the items top University of Texas officials spoke to students about during pizza with the president Tuesday. The question and answer session, hosted by the Student Government Association, was held just outside the Student Activity Center. President Sandra Woodley said the university is planning to improve the quality of its space. The place that we're in right now is going to be completely redesigned, Woodley said. One element will be a one-ton Falcon. She's gorgeous. That will be in the middle of this quad. She's actually on a ship right now coming from Spain where she was, Woodley said. The Falcon was gifted by an anonymous donor to the university, Chief of the Staff, Executive Director of Communications, Tatum Hubbard, said. Woodley said there would be a contest to name the Falcon. We're going to redo all of the spaces here around the quad, Woodley said. That's part of what we call our campus transformation plan. Pretty soon you will see under the Mesa deck a lot of really great outdoor sturdy furniture. It's going to be a lot of fun, bright color furniture for you to be able to hang out outside. It'll have plug-ins so that you can do that. The library building across from here, we have the money to completely renovate the first floor of the library, Woodley added. The outdoor furnishings were funded through HERF, funding to support outdoor learning and living as a preventative strategy against COVID. HERF stands for Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund, and it is part of the Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act. Library renovations and projects are funded through support from Odessa Development Corporation, Permanent University Fund, PUF, and Blackstone Launchpad. Part of the campus transformation will also include entrances and signage. We've got those tombstones that kind of halfway show you where you're supposed to go. That's going to get a full facelift and upgrade, she added. The stragglers, the bronze cattle at 42nd and JBS Parkway, will be moved back, and that corner will be a new plaza for the community and the students. The plaza will include a memorial to the victims of the August 29, 2019 mass shooting. It's called Bright Stars Memorial. Light will emanate from the cylinder that will go out on there, but we will also open up that space, Woodley said. She added that UTPB wants the students to be part of the design of the plaza, quad, walking paths, and entrances. Woodley noted that the number one goal is to make sure students get a University of Texas education and their academics are strong. Both Woodley and Vice President for Student Affairs and Leadership, Becky Spurlock, said they will be glad to hear student ideas on how to improve the campus. Spurlock said she's there to listen if things are going wrong as well. This fall should be a really good one. We're really excited to kick off our new athletic schedule. We've got our first home football game coming up Friday, September 3rd. It's going to be here on campus, so we're excited about that, Spurlock said. She noted that Welcome Week is still going on and there was a COVID vaccine clinic later in the afternoon Tuesday. Spurlock also stressed the importance of staying on track academically. She said the Student Success Center is offering more help and tutoring. We've got some student peer leaders who are going to be embedded in some classes to provide one-on-one and group support for academic areas. We're going to be rolling out a program called Making the Grade. So during COVID, you didn't do so well in a class and you want the opportunity to retake that class, we're going to help you do that financially. We'll be announcing that program to the students that are eligible this week, Spurlock said. A student success hotline has been started. The number is 432-552-4035. So if you don't know where to go, there are people who will answer the phone until 8 p.m. during the week. And then we'll get back to you to help you with whatever you need. My office is up on the fourth floor. I'm around the corner from Dr. Woodley, but you'll see me and, of course, Dean of Student Services, Corey Benson, out and about on campus, she said. She told those attending to never be afraid to stop her, ask questions, and tell her what's on their minds. Spurlock said they are almost giddy to have students back on campus, but at the same time she's worried because the hospitals are filling up with COVID cases. COVID continues to be a significant issue in our community and our populations under vaccinated. So, if you have questions about, concerns about being vaccinated, and you want to connect with me, I can connect you to a medical practitioner, and you can have a confidential conversation to get your questions answered, if that would help you make your decision, Spurlock said. She added that there is a link on the university's vaccine incentive webpage. If you haven't seen that, we are incentivizing people to get vaccines, Spurlock said. The grand prize is one semester of tuition and fees at UTPB. The drawing is October 6th. Details are listed at tinyurl.com/YP3ES5YP. Please get vaccinated. Take care of yourself and your friends, Spurlock said. Spurlock said the university is going to open the Center for Inclusion and Belonging on the second floor of the Student Activity Center. We're shooting to have our grand opening in the spring, she said. Woodley said plans are to upgrade technology around UTPB. We're also completing, or maybe already have completed, extra Wi-Fi in our quad and in our buildings to make it very easy for you to connect and a better strength, Woodley said. Also from the front page, census number far below early predictions. City's Hispanic population nears 60%, by Federico Martinez. Census figures have fallen far below what early predictions were for both Odessa and Ector County. Odessa's population is getting larger and browner, with 57.6% of the community's 114,428 residents identifying as Hispanic Latino, recently released 2020 U.S. Census Bureau figures show. Odessa Chamber of Commerce's Director of Economic Development, Wesley Burnett, said the city census's numbers surprised him. I'd say we were definitely undercounted, Burnett said. Whether it was COVID, the count, or people just didn't participate, it's clear we're underrepresented. New housing has continued to grow. Our economy has remained steady. The growth has been here, regardless of what the census numbers say. The latest census numbers show that 65,911 Hispanic Latino residents live in Odessa, a 7% increase over 2000, when 50,601 people of Hispanic Latino descendants were recorded. There were 37,753 Hispanics Latinos counted during the 2000 U.S. Census. This isn't really a surprise. For the last 20 years, we've seen this trend, the Latino population, continue to grow, said Angela Garcia, executive partner of BAM, a business consulting firm based in Odessa and Midland. We're a country that's becoming more diverse. The Permian Basin is a great example of this. The growing Latino population is playing a strong economic factor in the success of communities like Odessa, Garcia said. The population growth increases the demand for housing, provides businesses with a stronger workforce, and puts more money back into the local economy, Garcia added. Recent data compiled by Odessa's Hispanic Chamber of Commerce shows more than half of all businesses in Odessa are Hispanic Latino owned. Diversity is a good thing, Garcia said. It gives people more choices and creates more competition. Overall, Odessa's population grew by 14,488 people during the past decade for a current total of 114,428 residents. Odessa's white population, not Hispanic or Latino, accounts for 33.8% of the city's population, or 38,676. The city's African American population increased slightly from 5,736 residents, or 5.74%, to 6,866, or 6%. Asian Americans increased from 1,115 people, or 1.12%, to 1,716, or 1.5%. The American Indian and Alaska Native population decreased from 960 people, or 0.96%, to 68, or 0.6%. Other population numbers included people of two or more races, which were not identified by the census. The city does continue to face challenges, Burnett said. Unemployment remains at 8%, and the oil and gas industry has taken longer to get back on its feet, Burnett said. I'm more concerned about being underrepresented by the census because that's what's used to qualify the city for funding dollars and support programs, Burnett said. Burnett said he believes Odessa's true population is closer to the 123,334 number initially estimated by the census prior to the official count. The 2020 census details that 52.2% of Odessa residents are between the ages of 19 and 64, with persons between 6 and 18 representing 28.9%. Residents 65 years and older accounted for 10.1%, and children 5 years and younger 8.8%. The number of females living in Odessa dipped slightly, with females accounting for 50.3% of the current population versus 51.03% in 2010. The 2020 census noted that 59.7% of Odessans owned their own homes from 2015 to 2019, with the median value of those homes averaging $151,500. The median monthly mortgage payment was $1,469. The median gross rent was $1,091. There were a total of 40,827 households recorded from 2015 to 2019, with an average of 2.89 people living in each household. About 41.6% of those households, residents over the age of 5, spoke another language other than English in the home. Overall, 90.2% of households in Odessa own a computer, and 83.7% have a broadband internet subscription. Education-wise, 79.8% of Odessans have a high school education or higher, 4% lower than the statewide average, and 9% lower than the national average. About 18.5% of Odessa residents ages 25 or older have earned a bachelor's degree or higher, compared to the statewide average of 29.9% and 32.1% nationwide. According to the census, 8.1% of Odessans, residents under the age of 65, have a disability. 1 out of every 5 residents under the age of 65 in Odessa lacks health insurance, about 1% less than the state average and 10.5% below the national average. Odessa's median household income in 2019 dollars is $63,847, according to census statistics for income and poverty. Per capita income during the past 12 months in 2019 dollars was $30,470. Approximately 11.1% of Odessans live in poverty, or 3.6% lower than the state average. Census numbers for Ector County mirror the city. Ector County's population increased by 21.2% during the past decade, with the current population recorded as 137,136 people. That's nearly 30,000 less than early census estimates that predicted the county's population would be 166,223. About 62.6% of the county's population is of Hispanic Latino descent.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.